33 of the Did You Bring the Hummus podcast. I'm Kimberly, your host, and I'm super excited to be here with you today. Did You Bring the Hummus is a podcast to help you go vegan. This season, I'm sharing new episodes every Monday discussing all things vegan. Most importantly, we'll talk about how to embrace this meaningful decision with fervor and fun. Episodes post every Monday on your favorite podcast app. Before we get started, I have one very important question for you. Did you bring the hummus? Today, I am joined by Sam Tucker of Veg Catalyst. Sam is the co-founder and CEO of Veg Catalyst, a social enterprise dedicated to helping accelerate the spread of veganism through digital marketing. Veg Catalyst is the parent company to Vegan Creative Compass, a vegan digital marketing agency, Vegan Media Market, a vegan freelancer marketplace, VEG3, a vegan artificial intelligence marketing tool, and VegCademy, an online learning platform for vegan businesses and animal charities. Sam has been vegan and heavily involved in animal rights activism for more than 14 years, spending 5 of those working full-time for the nonprofit group Vegan Outreach. In this episode, we discuss digital marketing, AI, yep, I ask about Skynet, his VegCademy, and so many other things. This is awesome. Let's go. Hey, Sam. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
I am super excited to talk with you today. You have so many cool things going on in your vegan business. But before we get to that, I would love for you to share your vegan journey.
Yeah, for sure. So mine was a long one, started when I was pretty young. I was 11 years old and I read a book about, so this was a fictional book. It was about teenage spies that infiltrated this supposedly radical animal rights terrorist organization. So obviously fictional, like they were doing things that happened in, you know, the reality of the animal rights movement. But within the book, the teenage spies were talking to the activists about what happens in factory farms. And I remember reading that at 11 years old and thinking that that has to be part of the fiction of the book. There's no way that that can actually be what we're doing to animals. Mm-hmm. But I went and Googled it to see if that was true or not. And I came across all of the videos of how animals are treated in factory farms. And that was the start of what was a few year journey for me towards becoming vegan. So I grew up in like rural dairy farming country in New Zealand. Like, I hadn't even heard of vegetarian at the time, yet alone vegan. So I started off, I just didn't eat animals that were factory farmed. And then a little bit later, I saw that episode of The Simpsons where Lisa goes vegetarian. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I'd ever actually heard about vegetarianism. And immediately I just thought like, wait, hold on. If I'm just like not eating animals from factory farms at the moment, like why am I doing that when I could just not eat any animals at all? So I went vegetarian straight away. And then from there, I started getting more involved with some local animal rights activism. There was a lot of protests against like the circus, for example. At that time, we still had like wild animals and circuses like elephants and stuff. We actually, through that campaign, managed to get I think she was actually the last elephant in like the circus industry in New Zealand. We actually got her out of there and into a sanctuary. So that was really cool. But through doing that, I met a lot of people who were vegan and I started talking to them about what happens in the dairy and egg industries. And then it was just the natural next step from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. And every time I meet someone who started this journey young, I'm so, so glad for them because I didn't go vegetarian until I was 20. And so people who kind of have that realization when they're kids and start on that path a little more clearly, so lucky.
Yeah, I think it's like the only regret any vegan has is wishing that they had done it sooner. And I think that doesn't change if you went vegan when you were young as well. You still wish like, oh, I wish I had figured this out earlier.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That is amazing too. Are there still circuses in New Zealand that have animals, just not elephants?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there are, I mean, I'm not 100% sure, to be honest, but I'm fairly sure that there are domestic animals in circuses, but there's not wild animals in circuses anymore.
Okay, wow. I mean, that's still a huge
definitely a huge step change. In the right direction.
Yeah, I remember when Ringling Brothers here in the US, had started announcing that they were kind of losing money and that they were trying to drum up participation again, and people just weren't showing up, and then they finally announced they had to shut down. Oh, I was so happy. And people might hear me say that and be like, but people lost jobs and their livelihoods and stuff. But I mean, when you consider the amount of cruelty that these animals are subjected to every day to entertain us when there's so many other options, I feel like they'll find other things to do.
Yeah, 100%. And it's not even like it's putting the industry as a whole out of work. Like there's so many amazing, like Cirque du Soleil, for example, with all like human circus performers. And I think that's so much more entertaining to watch too than, an animal that doesn't want to be there.
Exactly, right. They all choose to be there. They all choose to do these amazing, crazy, scary things. But yeah, it is a lot. I just went to one. It wasn't a Cirque du Soleil, but it was kind of like a horror themed, Halloween themed one. I
Oh,
can't remember what it
interesting.
was called, but it was so cool. And they did kind of some of the traditional like magician acts, cut someone in half or move them from one side of the stage to the other without you seeing them go anywhere. But they also did like high flying things, and it was just amazing and super entertaining. There were kids there who thoroughly enjoyed it too, and it was just yeah, like we don't need to be subjecting other beings who don't get to tell us whether or not they want to do it to
Yeah,
such.
absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
All right. Let's see. You are quite a busy businessman. You
Well, they don't call
are.
the busyness for nothing.
Exactly. So tell me about Veg Catalyst, how it started, where it came from, and all of the other cool stuff that's kind of within that
Yeah.
home.
For sure. So, as a little bit of background, before I started Veg Catalyst, I was working within the nonprofit space. So, I worked for an organization called Vegan Outreach. We used to hand out leaflets about veganism at university campuses. And so, I did that for 5 years full time, like going to every university in Australia and New Zealand at least once every semester. So, during that time, I think that we did achieve, as an organization, a lot of good for animals. And we had a lot of, really incredible donors and volunteers that supported all of that. And it did definitely have an impact. Like every day, we would get people coming up to us, telling us that they had gone vegan as a result, or were at least like, starting to think about it, reducing their consumption. But there were two limits that I kind of noticed and my ability to be able to scale my impact in that kind of work. So the first one was the nature of everything being in person, one-on-one. It's like you only have so many hours in the day. So therefore there's this hard limit on how many people you can actually talk to. Whereas, so to put this in perspective, it's like in a single day of leafleting, you might be able to hand out something like 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 leaflets with like a big team of volunteers. But then you could go home and make a post on Facebook and reach 10 times that amount of people overnight. So I sort of thought that digital was this really unique opportunity that we had as activists to be able to really massively scale up our impact. And the other limitation that I noticed too in the nonprofit space was that there just wasn't enough resources and funding in the movement to really compete against the size of the animal industry. So there's a really depressing statistic that is all of the operating budgets for every animal rights charity, any free animal welfare charity, their entire operating budgets. It doesn't even add up to something like 10% of the marketing budget for a company like Tyson or McDonald's. So there's really a lack of like financial resources in the movement. And while all these organizations are doing absolutely incredible work with those limited resources they do have, I sort of thought if there was a way that I could be doing activism for animals in a way that was self-sustaining financially and allowed me to give back to the movement as well, and also to move it online, then I thought I could increase my impact that way. So the natural kind of I guess the natural next step was then digital marketing because it kind of ticked both of those boxes. So I went back to university. I did a Bachelor of Communications with a major in digital marketing. And then I founded Veg Catalyst from there. So at first we were just Vegan Creative Compass, which is the marketing agency side of what we did. But from there, we've expanded to do stuff in artificial intelligence and to create like freelancer marketplaces as well. So the theory behind that was basically we're running the agency. It was again this kind of issue of sort of noticing where we weren't able to scale as much as we wanted to with the impact. So, you know, with a marketing agency, it's like there's only so many people that you can actually like manage, only so many clients that you can, you know, handle as one person or even as a team of people. But if you could create a software that did some of these tasks, then that's infinitely scalable. Anyone can use that software. And similar idea with the freelancer marketplace. And we've also, we've been doing online courses and things like that as well. So it's really just about trying to find out, trying to think about more ways that we can scale the impact we have for animals by offering, you know, products that help vegan businesses and animal charities to be more effective in their efforts online, whether that's, you know, as an individual activist and improving your effectiveness in that area, or whether that's as a vegan business and improving your return on your investment for digital marketing.
That's really awesome. I, you know, just for me, from like a like individual little businessy person that I am, I know that I don't really enjoy some of the marketing pieces. I love talking to people. I want to do that. But I don't necessarily love writing things up or creating content. And to know that there are not just, I mean, of course, there are tons of companies I could reach out to that could do that for me. But knowing that there's a vegan business, there's a deeper understanding there, right? Because I could just go to like a regular marketing firm and be like, here's what I want. You know, I have a vegan company and this is what I want it to say. And they might get that, but they're not going to get it. But like you, yeah, and your people, like you guys understand not just where I'm coming from a business perspective, but where I'm coming from in my heart and like the purpose within my life. And, you know, these choices I make every day that are within that vegan realm are things that you just understand.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is such a different thing with vegan business too, because for most of us who are vegan business owners, we don't just consider it solely a way to make money. Obviously, that's important. You got to, you know, you can do more good for animals with a profit than you can with a loss. But at the same time, it's like most of us have a much deeper purpose. We see this as an extension of our activism for animals. We see this as, you know, creating a better world. And I think it's very hard for an agency to be able to promote those sort of brand values if they don't actually hold those values themselves.
Yeah, I agree. There's only so much you can kind of fake that way, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And just kind of a quick aside, I just want to mention about vegan outreach. So, you know, I've been vegetarian for a very long time and I kept saying, I want to go vegan. I knew I'd been on and off vegan for a long, like on and off for like a couple of years. And I kept saying, I want to go vegan, but I was struggling so much with cheese and I was like dating at the time and it's like, oh, what a pain in the ass you are that like we, you know, you're vegan and blah, blah, blah. So I was back and forth. And Vegan Outreach has a really cool mentor program. And yeah, I connected with a woman and by just through email, we just emailed each other and she got me over that hump to like let go of cheese and finally just be the full vegan that I knew I was meant to be. That was like 7-8 years ago at this point, but just like they do so much with the, like the leafleting and the that kind of stuff, but they have this really cool connection. I don't know if other organizations do, but that's the one that I thought was super like meaningful and really helpful. So I kind of just wanted to give them a shout out since you mentioned them that you'd work with them.
Yeah, they're an incredible organization. They're doing, you know, a lot of really great work. And the thing I liked about working with them too is they're very evidence-based in their approach to, you know, so for example, with the leaflets that we used to hand out, like they would have split test, for example, like handing out so many leaflets, trying to get people to fill out surveys and seeing like actually what the measurable impact of that was in terms of diet change. So it's funny looking back, that was probably like the first sort of marketing split tests that, you know, I was ever doing. And you weren't thinking about it that way at the time. You thought we're just trying to be more effective for animals. but it's essentially the same kind of idea. And I think that data-driven approach is really important, as well as that personal approach, like you mentioned with the mentorship program. I think it's like, you really need that balance between, you know, reaching a large number of people, but also like reaching people in a really personalized way.
Yep. I could not agree more. I love that we have things like social media and those things where, like you said, we can reach thousands and thousands of people with one post, but we still also have to have that one-on-one connection wherever we can to help drive the mission forward, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that really like links into like digital marketing a lot too, because I think that there's a tendency I feel in some areas of digital marketing where people kind of become too reliant on the technology rather than viewing the technology as a tool to help improve human connection, you know, rather than just, you know, I mean, any business owner who has an email address listed publicly probably knows exactly what I'm talking about with all of the spam that they get from, you know, automated people sending cold emails. It's like, you know, nothing wrong with necessarily using that sort of technology, but it really has to be personalized. And you have to know who it is you're speaking to and like what's going to resonate with them.
So tell me more about that and how that kind of is part of the work that you're doing.
Yeah, so it's still very early days with this in terms of what we're doing with VG3, our artificial intelligence software. But ultimately, the goal with that is we're going to be able to enable much more personalized interactions at scale online. So basically, one of the really cool things about AI is that it's very, very highly scalable. So, you know, if you were, say, trying to write individual emails to like 10,000 people on a mailing list, it's going to take you a lifetime to do that. But the cool thing about AI is that it can sort of look at the data around how's this person interacting with my business. For example, like, you know, what pages on my website have they visited? Have they been watching content? How much have they been watching? And you can then start to create these personalized segments that are sort of responding to where people are currently at in their customer journey.
Hmm. Wow. I love this. I'm thinking about, you know, that when you set up the emails to nurture as someone joins your mailing list, right? And right now, at least the way mine is set up, it's very generic, right? Because you only have, I mean, I've got limitations within my the email software that I use because I'm not at the point where I can pay for like the top of the line one. So I'm working within the budget that I have. And so I only have like one option. Maybe I can send five total over the nurturing plan, but they all are kind of like dear, and then they'll put the name in, but everything else is very much the same. You can't change it for every person. And like you said, to go in and do personal emails that way, when your business is very small and maybe you only have a handful of people on your mailing list, sure, you could do that. But once you're like even double digits, it's not really feasible to go in and do that anymore. So to have something that still gives that personal touch while allowing you to focus on the other pieces that also help build your business, you're really giving an opportunity for the vegans to, you know, really push their business and send that message forward. And then the AI, and I know every time I've talked to you, I'm always like, oh my God, it's just the thing I mention every single time is about how it can be utilized when we are being stressed out online, because there are a lot of people who don't quite get the message yet. And they are more than happy to comment on a vegan post like, but bacon though, or meat, or something super gross like that. And for one, like, how do these people not realize yet that each time they do that, it bumps the algorithm to show them more vegan stuff? So, I mean, it's just spreading the message more, but also then they have to see more of it. But the emotional tax that it puts on you as a vegan business owner, when you're being like shit on, or when they're just trying to say things that are cruel and expose you to that, like, the cruelty side of it, it's so draining and it's so hard. And our efforts can be better utilized doing other things. So with that long introduction, can you tell us about how you see the AI helping vegan businesses and people deal with that kind of interaction?
Yeah, well, one of the funny things that I think about this is the fact that we can train an AI so easily to respond to these kind of comments just shows how, like, predictable these comments are. Like, it does not take a lot of training data. There's maybe like somewhere between 5 and 20 of the same arguments that you hear just repeated in different ways. So yeah, the way that we did this when we were putting this together is basically we scoured the internet for all of these sort of anti-vegan comments. And we basically just wrote a bunch of responses to this. We had a few hundred examples of this, and we fed that information into the AI. And that was enough now that it can pretty much respond to any anti-vegan comment. And it does so in like a very, like, not a generic way. It's really, so what the AI isn't doing, this is a little bit of a misconception. Sometimes people seem to think that what the AI does is it's just like looking at its training data and mishing and mashing bits and pieces together to create a response. So that's not actually the way it works. The way it works is like actually quite a bit more advanced than that. The way that it's working is essentially it's figuring out the patterns for itself as to why that output is associated with the input, if that makes sense. So it's actually getting a deeper understanding rather than just like input A equals input B. It has what we call a neural net, which is like basically different like mathematical weights in the computer program, all that are associated with like different aspects of what the software is doing. So if you get a large enough number of those and you have layers of those on top of each other, it actually replicates very similarly what's happening in our brain, the way that our neurons interconnect and send information back and forth. So you actually get like a software that understands what is being said in the inputs, and it understands how it should respond to, I guess, give a counter argument to that.
Wow. I'm not at all like a technical person or anything like that. So the explanations are like, oh my gosh, that's so amazing that people can like do this and figure this out. But I also just feel like in my heart and in my stomach, like just how important and meaningful that is for our movement. And I'm just so excited to have you here and sharing that information. So how do people, is this available now? Can people use it now? Or when are you expecting? Tell us that.
Yeah, absolutely. So at the moment, we're in what we call a public beta test. So we have trained all of these various models. So we have the one, like I said, that's responding to anti-vegan comments, but we also have like a large number of other types of text generation. For example, we have AIs that can write social media captions, they can write blog posts, even press releases, even generate vegan recipes as well. That one's pretty fun to use, actually. You can just like basically put in the ingredients that you have lying around your house and it'll put together a recipe for them. Oh my gosh. So, yeah. So all of these, basically we trained them to the point where they were giving us really good responses when we used it. But there is a little bit of a problem there because we're only a small team of, you know, humans with our own individual biases, our own individual ways of writing the inputs. So basically what we're doing now is we're opening it up to the public to see how it responds to the different ways that people write, you know? So during that, we're actively looking out for the bugs in the system. Where does it get confused? Like, what kind of language does it not understand? And so we figured out a lot of that from our public beta so far. And so we're in the process of retraining models. And maybe by the time this podcast comes out, those might even actually, you know, be online. But at this stage, we're in that public beta and we're getting very close to having the final models released.
That's amazing. My question, and you kind of answered it, I think, was around, you know, that kind of the biases, like, and when are you able to kind of filter that stuff out by allowing in like the public and allowing in so many different kinds of people to kind of make sure that there isn't that kind of influence over the AI?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's what we're trying to do through the public beta test. Genuinely is a very hard problem in AI, though. I think that it's difficult to get 100% right. And you see this in a lot of like the large language models and the AI image generators that are being made. So a lot of them, like, no human has even reviewed all the data because there's too much. So if you take something like GPT-3 from OpenAI, or you look at like Stable Diffusion, one of these image generation models, they're trained on something ridiculous, like 10-20% of the entire internet. So no one's read through and filtered out the bias. So therefore, sometimes those models can reflect back the bias of the internet, which obviously, does contain a lot of very negative bias. So what we've been doing with VEG3 is much more careful than that. We have people reviewing, the inputs and the outputs. Well, sorry, I should clarify that. Not for like every time the AI generates something, but when we were collecting the training data, all of that was manually reviewed by a diverse team of people on our team. So like different cultures, genders, sexual orientations, etc. So we've always tried to be conscious of that. But that said, there's all sorts of ways that people have unconscious bias that we might not realize. And even not in like the negative sense, but it could just be in terms of like a bias towards say like using certain words to describe something instead of another. Like maybe you say big instead of huge, and then that bias, makes get really confused when someone uses huge. So that's sort of where we're at with this public beta, is it's more things like that, just the way that people write and the different ways people express themselves. We're trying to make sure that the AI can kind of respond to all of that.
Okay, that is super responsible. I'm very, it's funny, just in the last week did I hear about these AI image generators. I had not heard of this before, and I honestly don't know enough to even have a conversation with you, but just want to make a point that one woman that I follow a lot of fat activists, and there's a lot of bias, weight bias on the internet, right? And she had shared some of the AI images that were generated based on her photos. And she pointed out that this AI was trying to make her thin. She's like, despite every photo that has a double chin in it, I look perfectly thin and symmetrical and all of that in these photos. And that's got to be where that's coming from, right? That bias that, thin is better than fat in this, the example that she was giving. That's my guess anyway.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. What it's doing is it's reflecting the overall bias of the internet. So it's a complex issue because it's a really difficult one for the people who develop AI systems to address. So I don't blame the people who put these, these AI models together. And so when you look at Stable Diffusion, that's kind of the one that's been the most public at the moment. And what their approach to this was to open source the problem. So they said there's going to be bias within our AI models. We know that they're not perfect, but if we make them open source, we allow everyone access to the code. People can fine tune their own models. They can find out where the errors are. So I do, I have a lot of sympathy for that approach, but I think it's very debatable which approach is better. Like, is it better to do that, to release a model that is flawed so that the public can help to improve it? Or is it better to sort of hold tighter control of that model and wait until you've tested it more? I think there's like a valid argument for both approaches. So it's a hard one to know what to do about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that is tough.
Yeah.
Kind of a silly question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How do you must, when you tell someone that you're working on AI,
mm-hmm.
especially anyone who's probably like 45, 50 and younger, do they ask you about Skynet and how are you not creating Skynet?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. I think, obviously there's like the sort of like Hollywood dramatized version of what could go wrong with AI. I don't think we have to worry about that so much, but there are very real concerns we do have to worry about with AI. So one of those, for example, is just the raw power of it. So AI is like, if you sort of like set a goal for it and you give it a huge amount of data, it can figure out how to achieve those goals in ways that humans couldn't, because we can't read through, you know, 20% of the internet, for example. Right. It's just not possible. So I do think AI is a very powerful tool. And like any tool, it can be used for good or it can be used for bad. So the analogy that I like to use is it's kind of like a sledgehammer. You could use a sledgehammer to build an orphanage and have a really positive impact in the world, or you could use it to smash someone's head in and have a really horrible impact. So it's not that the sledgehammer is good or bad either way, it's the way that people use it. So similarly, when we have a really powerful tool like AI, I think it does become very important to start having conversations around how do we want these things used. And I think that at the moment, it's like our regulation isn't keeping up with how fast the technology is changing. So we're going to have a wider societal conversation about, you know, how do we want these systems to be used? Who's in control of these systems? You know, and I don't necessarily have all the answers to all of that as well. I think there's also going to be all sorts of problems that come up that we don't foresee and that we couldn't predict, but also all sorts of benefits that come up that we couldn't predict as well. So I think the best thing at the moment is, you know, this technology is constantly evolving whichever way we look at it, but we should be trying to, I guess, progress its evolution in a responsible way with the right goals in mind.
And that just goes right back to your driving force of veganism, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we're trying to make the world a better place, be responsible, make the choices that serve more of us than less of us.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that. I do. This was so interesting. And I wish that I knew more about AI so I could ask you better questions. But I think that what you've shared about that in particular is going to be really useful and interesting for my listeners. So you talked about the digital marketing piece of Veg Catalyst, and you've talked about the AI piece, but I believe you also have like a Veg Academy, or I might be misnaming that, but there's another piece to it, right?
Yeah, very close. It's Veg Academy. So it's basically the same thing. So yeah, what we do with that is basically online courses. So at the moment, we've only got one up, which is basically teaching animal rights charities how to apply for Google ad grants. So by applying for those ad grants, they get $10,000 worth of free advertising spend every single month. You do have to be a registered charity to be eligible for it. But basically, once you get that, we then guide charities through with our course on how to spend it effectively and how to make sure that they're getting the maximum impact from it. And we also run a pro bono program through our marketing agency. So every month we work directly with an animal charity to actually set up all the ads on their behalf. And then we kind of have that course there as well for them to maintain that going forward.
That's really beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Oh, I love so much meaning there. But thank you for doing that. That's really important.
Yeah, well, I really, you know, that's been such a core part of my goal with, you know, the whole business is, to me, I don't see it even just as a business. I see it as a social enterprise. It's like, obviously we have to make profit to, you know, be sustainable and to be able to, you know, keep increasing our impact and growing. But at the same time, it's like our impact is at the core of what we do. And, you know, profit is a way to achieve that, not something to achieve instead of that.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting too, that because I think that's a lesson, I guess that's the word I'll use, a lesson that a lot of us need to learn, because we're coming from it like, we just want to help. We want to change the world so the animals are safe. We want to make the world a better place. And it almost feels like dirty to be like, I also want to make money while I do it. But if we're not making money, if we can't pay our bills, if we can't function in the world, we don't have then the bandwidth to do the activism piece. But we also, we'll be more effective and have more to give. You know, like I used to have,
absolutely.
I'm kind of like going off on a tangent here, losing my train of thought, and I'm sorry about that. But I used to always think like, people who have money are just not good people. And I, you know, they give to charities because they want to seem like good people. But now I realize that if I could be in a position to make a boatload of money, that would be amazing, because I know what I would do with that, the way I would help move forward the cause. And it makes trying to build my own business feel a lot less like I need to feel bad when someone pays me for something, because I'm offering a service and they pay it, and it goes back into the vegan world and moving things forward. So I appreciate you making that point, because I think there are a lot of us that are still like, we're not supposed to make money. We're supposed to be struggling, and it's supposed to be hard, and everything's supposed to go just towards the cause. But having that ability to make a profit really helps us.
100%. I think that mindset thing is so important too. And it's definitely something that I struggled with in my early days too. Cause again, like my background coming from the nonprofit space, you know, I was used to like basically like sleeping on people's couches as we moved around trying to save the organization money, and, you know, just like living this extremely frugal life because of obviously, you know, nonprofit wages being what they are, and just being motivated by that. So I similarly, when I got into this at first, had that mindset of like, well, really what I should be doing is I should be charging all of my clients like the absolute lowest price where I can barely just make it work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, treating that as like my activism. But then what I found is like, you can't scale that, and you can't grow, and you can't help more people. And also, like, if you're good at what you do, if you're providing a service, like, people only continue buying that service from you if the value they get is more than the money that you're asking for anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you, like, I think that, yeah, a lot of small businesses, I think in particular, a lot of like small vegan businesses often like underprice themselves for that reason, that they just want to help. But I think that, yeah, that mentality does need to shift a little bit to see that, you know, setting fair prices for yourself is, it doesn't mean that you're like exploiting your client for money. You're still like providing a service to them that's probably making them more money than they're spending. I mean, if they're a business, that's like why they're buying from you, right? Mm-hmm. So that was a big thing for me too, was like comparing the service fee I was charging to how much profit and revenue we were actually bringing businesses through our marketing services.
You have a podcast. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's under the same brand as like the courses that we do, Veg Academy. So basically, that's a podcast teaching vegan business owners and animal rights charities about digital marketing skills and strategies that they can use in their business or charity.
Awesome. I will be checking that out, because I certainly need the help. is there anything I've missed from Veg Catalyst, or anything that you would like to share that we haven't covered yet?
No, I think we've probably covered most things. I guess the one thing I'd want to say to anyone listening, if you want to like learn more about this, our website is vegcatalyst.com. And from there, you can find like all the links to, you know, these other things we're doing, whether that's, you know, Vegan Creative Compass, our marketing agency, Vegan Media Market, our freelancer marketplace platform, Veg Academy, our online courses, or VEG3, our artificial intelligence software.
Awesome. And all of the link will be in the show notes, as well as your social media, so they'll be able to connect with you. No problem.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So Sam, this has been amazing. And I'm so, so thankful that you were able to join me tonight for this recording. I've got one final question, and everyone who listens knows that it's coming. Mm-hmm. But tell us about either your favorite way to eat hummus or your favorite hummus.
So by far, my favorite type of hummus is pumpkin and kumara hummus. For anyone who's outside New Zealand, kumara is sweet potato. It's like the indigenous word for it over here. But I'm absolutely obsessed with it. Me and my partner, we buy like a kilo of that a week, and it's usually gone within a few days.
That is fantastic. What do you like to eat it on? How do you... like, what's your
mostly just crackers? So I mean, I love it on everything. Like, it's great in wraps and burgers, things like that. But the way that it really goes quickly is just like directly with crackers, with like a ratio of probably like 90% hummus to 1% cracker. I don't know what the other 9% is. My maths is a bit off there.
I agree. Dipping into hummus, big old scoop right on a small cracker is absolutely the best way to eat it.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Sam, so much. The information you've shared is invaluable, and I know that my listeners will be wowed and excited for all the things that you have to offer.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks, me too. I loved this conversation with Sam. We went in so many directions, and what he's working on is truly transformative for the vegan movement. What are your thoughts on AI, or how we can effectively use digital marketing to spread the vegan message, not just far and wide, but effectively? Also, I've never had hummus with pumpkin or kumara. How about you? I think I'm going to give it a try. To connect with Sam or keep up with what he's up to, visit his website, vegcatalyst.com. You'll also find links to his social media and YouTube channel in the show notes. I hope you found this episode helpful and inspiring. Please subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you're loving it, please give Did You Bring the Hummus a 5-star rating. It's an easy way to keep supporting the show. You are also invited to join my free private Facebook group for fans of the show. You can find that link in the show notes. Also, it's January, which means Veganuary. There's still time to sign up for my free Jump Into January with Veganuary coaching group. We meet every Tuesday during the month of January to help support your Veganuary efforts. Find out more via the link in the show notes. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Did You Bring the Hummus, and visit my website, didyoubringthehummus.com, for more information about me, updates on what I'm working on, new podcast episodes, and all things vegan. And finally, I would love to hear from you. What do you need help with? Is there a topic you want to hear covered on a future episode? DM me on Instagram or send me an email at didyoubringthehummus@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.